Russia. Everywhere is Christmas.
At the end of every year.
Oh, everywhere is Christmas. At the end of every year.
I said that.
Everywhere is Christmas. At the end of every year.
One more time now.
Everywhere is Christmas. At the end of every year.
The sound of the most celebrated pop group the world has ever known, the Beatles, singing a song which was specially recorded and distributed free to members of their fan club at Christmas 1966.
Yesterday you are
all my troubles seem so far away. Now it looks as though the hit is day.
Oh, bless
you all on Christmas Day.
Christmas Day.
A big year for us.
Christmas Day.
One of our biggest years since we can remember.
Christmas Day.
And we can remember a lot of big years. Take bugs.
Christmas Day.
Christmas Day.
And especially those abroad and those of you in BOR 245-9783.
Christmas Day.
There's a lot of them here. One of which.
Starting in 1963, the Beatles found that they were forced to live both their professional and private lives publicly, their every move avidly watched and their every utterance copiously reported by the popular elements of the world's press. Christmases proved to be times of particularly frenzied activity, with films, television and radio appearances, sell-out live shows on stage, and records topping both singles and album charts. For the next hour, we're going to recall some of the achievements of this unique group, with special reference to The Beatles at Christmas. Magical Mystery Tour was the title song of the Beatles' own TV special, which was given its world premiere by the BBC 16 years ago on Boxing Day 1967. Vilified by critics and coolly received by a bewildered public, this was the group's first failure in 4 years. Back in late 1963, it had seen they could do no wrong. Their fame had been rapidly achieved and had increased with every move. Each succeeding new record became an instant number one hit. They made regular appearances on radio and television and toured constantly. Their cheeky sense of humour met with almost universal acclaim. As evidence of this, by Christmas 1963, the Beatles held the top two album places with Please Please Me and With the Beatles, and they also had two hit singles. One was She Loves You, which had been in the charts for 4 months, and this was the other.
Oh, yeah, I'll tell you something. I think you'll understand. When I say that something, I wanna hold your hand. Happy inside. It's such a feeling that my love. It's such a feeling that my love, I can hide, I can hide, I can hide. Yeah, you got that something, I think you understand. When I feel that something, I wanna hold your hand.
Song that was the number one hit during Christmas week 1963. Two other songs by Lennon and McCartney were in the top 20 as well. The charts were crammed with songs not only by the Beatles, but about them.
Christmas comes but once a year, they're really all the same. I never know just what I want, it really is a shame. Yesterday I saw something that is my pride and joy. I want it for Christmas. It's a real live Liverpool boy. All I want for Christmas is a Beetle. Not a teddy bear, just a Beetle. I told Mum that nothing else would do. There are four, so she can have. I don't care whichever one she gets me. Ringo, Paul, John, George, they're all the same. I can't wait for Christmas Day to come, 'cause all I want for Christmas is a Beetle.
Comedian Dora Brown. Well, how the Beatles themselves felt about the line, Ringo, John, George, Paul, they're all the same, has not been recorded, perhaps fortunately. Mind you, the four young men could have had precious little time to consider anything but their own activities, for manager Brian Epstein also presented them as the headline attraction in a London stage show. The supporting acts included friends and fellow Liverpudlians Cilla Black and Billy J. Kramer, a new group of impressionists, the Baron Knights, and the emergent Australian singer-comedian Rolf Harris. The show had a pantomime flavour with comedy sketches and music, and was a total success. During the 16 days of its run, it packed the Finsbury Park Astoria to capacity and was seen by over 100,000 people. But, seen by thousands, the Beatles were being heard by millions. Exactly 20 years ago, on Boxing Day 1963, everyone tuned to the BBC Light programme was listening to this.
It's the Beatles!
That adaptation of their hit song From Me to You was specially recorded by the Beatles as From Us to You in the BBC's Paris studio in London's Lower Regent Street, and it was used as the title song of the group's own two-hour radio special. In those days, the amount of airtime devoted to pop music was strictly limited, but a handful of perceptive producers at the BBC had spotted the Beatles' potential early on. As a result, the group had already made over 40 radio appearances by the end of 1963, including their own series of half-hour programmes, Pop Go the Beatles, for 15 weeks during the summer. This year also saw the first issue of the subsequently famous and much sought-after Beatles Christmas record. It was distributed free to the 80,000 members of the fan club. The head of press and publicity at that time for Brian Epstein's entertainment organisation, NEMS, was Tony Barrow.
That autumn, the fan mail that was coming in started to reach really staggering proportions, to such an extent that unopened mail, sacks of unopened mail, were being left on staircases 2, 3, 4 weeks waiting for the fan club staff to deal with them. And it was leading up towards Christmas, and I suddenly thought of the Queen's Christmas Day speech and wondered if in some way we could sort of have the Beatles do something in the way of a Christmas message, and it all really developed from there. I put the idea to Brian Epstein, and as usual, any idea at all that was going to cost money, Brian Epstein was automatically against, and then we talked to the Beatles about it, and they loved the idea, but they said that they must have a complete script written for them. They wanted to have it all written down so that they wouldn't be sitting around the microphone wondering kind of what to say. They said, well, if I would put together the kind of thing that I'd got in mind, the things that they should be saying to their fans, then by all means they'd do it. Well, I was very aware that their ad-lib humour was the best thing of all with the Beatles. When the Beatles were given scripts to read for any promotional purposes, they tended to either dry up altogether or be very stilted, or to read them wrongly, or to send them up. Now, as long as they were going to send this up, it was going to be great, and that's, of course, what happened. It started off rather straightly with John sort of saying, hello, this is John speaking with me voice, and his little message was fairly straightforward at the beginning, but gradually, as the thing went on, it got more and more out of hand. A beetle would goose another beetle just when he was at a serious part of his message. They'd break into whistling the national anthem when they'd just referred to the Royal Variety Show. So exactly what we wanted to happen did in fact happen.
Hello, this is John speaking with his voice. We're all very happy to be able to talk to you like this on this little bit of plastic. This record reaches you at the end of a really gay year for us, and it's all due to you. When we made our first record on Parlophone towards the end of 1962... we hoped everybody would like what we'd already been our type of music for several years already. But we had no idea of all the gear things in store for us. It all happened, really, when Please Please Me became a number one hit, and after that, well, Court of Blimey's Heather No. Our biggest thrill of the year, well, I suppose it must have been topping the bill at the London Palladium, and then, only a couple of days later, being invited to take part in the Royal Variety Show. This time last year, we were all dead chuffed because Love Me Do got into the top 20. And we can't believe, really, that so many things have happened in between already. Just before I pass you over to Paul, I'd like to say thank you to all the Beatle people who have written to me during the year, and everyone who sent me gifts and cards for my birthday, which I'm trying to forget, in October. I'd love to reply personally to everyone, but I just haven't enough pens. In the meantime, Gary Crimble to you, Gary Mimble to you, Getty Babel, dear Christmas, happy birthday, me too.
This is Paul here. Everything that John said goes for me too, especially the bit about birthday cards and the parcels, because all our homes and offices got stacks of mail last June.
Ow!
Well, it was my birthday. Anyway, we're all dead pleased by the way you've treated us in 1963. And we'll try to do everything we can to please you with the type of songs we write and record next year. Oh, yeah. Somebody asked us if we still like Jelly Babies. Well, we used to like them. In fact, we loved them. And we said so in one of the papers, you see. Ever since then, we've been getting them in boxes, packets and crates. Anyway, we've gone right off Jelly Babies, you see. But we still like Peppermint Creams and Chocolate Drops and Dolly Mitchell's and all those sort of things, don't we?
Yes, yes, oh yes.
Well, lots of people asked us what we enjoy best, you see. Concert and television or recording. We like doing stage shows because, you know, it's great to hear an audience enjoying themselves. But the thing we like best, I think so anyway, is going into the recording studio.
Yeah, lovely. We enjoy that.
Love
very
that,
kindly.
To make new records, which is what we've been doing all day before we started on this special message.
For the Beatles, the events of the 12 months of 1963 had been impressive enough. Their rise to fame and the scale of their success were unparalleled in the history of British pop music. But even they paled into insignificance compared with what happened in 1964, when people the world over fell under the spell of this incredible quartet. Throughout Europe and from Australia to America, they were feted as the ultimate superstars of pop. Theirs were undoubtedly the best known and most widely loved faces in the world. But did the extraordinary extent of this admiration distress them in any way? Apparently not.
Hello, everybody. This is Paul, and I'd just like to thank you all for buying our records during the past year. We know you've been buying them because the sales have been very good, you see. Don't know where we'd be without you, really, though.
In the army, perhaps.
Oh, we hope you've enjoyed listening to the records as much as we've enjoyed melting them. No, that's wrong. Making them. We're in number 2 studio at the moment at EMI, taping this little message for you.
Yes, we are.
So we are, indeed. I just thought I'd make the... This is the same studio we've used all along since the old days of Love Me Do. So many years ago, it seems.
Oh, those are the days.
Well, that's about all, I think. Sir, to wish you all a happy Christmas and a very new year. Now pass you over to John. John?
John speaking. Thanks all of you who bought me book. Thank you, folks, for buying it. It was very handy. And there's another one out pretty soon, it says here. Hope you buy that too. It'll be the usual rubbish, but it won't cost much. It's been a busy year, one way and another, but it's been a great year, too. You fans have seen to that. Page 2. Thanks a lot, folks, and a happy Christmas and a merry good year.
Christmas 1964 must have seemed to the Beatles very much like Christmas 1963. Again, they had a number one single, a double A-side release with I Feel Fine and She's a Woman, and again, the top two LPs, A Hard Day's Night and Beatles for Sale. The second of these, which had just been released, consisted of songs by Lennon and McCartney, alongside others that had been among their own favourites in the 50s.
Kick against my chest. Let's just try to play it too darn fast and lose the beauty of the melody.
Rock and roll music was composed by Chuck Berry, but that performance by the Beatles, with John Lennon singing lead, was a BBC recording transmitted 19 years ago on the Boxing Day edition of the pop programme which I'm proud to have introduced, Saturday Club. In December 1964, Brian Epstein again presented a stage spectacular. This time the venue was London's Hammersmith Odeon, where another Beatles Christmas show played 38 sell-out performances over its 20-night run. The show's formula was very much the same as that of its highly successful predecessor, and this time the support acts included Freddie and the Dreamers, the Yardbirds, Sounds Incorporated, and an 18-year-old unknown from Salford, Lancashire, Elkie Brooks. The compere was Jimmy Savile.
On one occasion on the show, we had to do, that's the four Beatles and myself, we had to do a sketch, and they were hardy mountaineers. And they had little donkeys, which they brought on stage, much to the delight of the guys and gals there. And I was an abominable snowman, dressed from head to foot in a big, hairy, shaggy-looking thing. And I captured the Beatles one by one and ate them. Well, I captured John and Paul and George. But when I went out to capture Ringo, and Ringo would turn around and do battle with me, and I would crash to the ground, and they would then... The end of the thing was where they would seize hold of my bear-type head and pull it off, revealing that it was Jimmy Savile, who, in Great Britain, is known for having long blonde hair and very easily recognisable. Now, this went on night after night after night, you see, and the Beatles can't stand anything going on for night after night after night, so they have to fix it up and queer it up somehow. So, I make my appearance. You see, they've been on with their donkeys, and all of a sudden I appear... over the top of this fantastic set, and I'm going, arr, arr. You see, everybody starts screaming. Whereupon all the Beatles turn round, jump on me, and pull the head off. Well, this is wrong, you see, because it's now not the abominable snowman, it's Jimmy Savile. But we can't finish the sketch there and then, because we've got to go, so we've got to grind through this dreadful sketch by now, with everybody knowing who I am, and every time I come out to carry one of the Beatles off, everybody starts going, get off! Get off!
Good to me, you know she's happy as can be, you know she said so. I'm in love with her and I feel fine. Baby says she's mine, you know she tells me all the time, you know she said so. I'm in love with her and I feel fine. I'm so glad that she's my little girl. She's so glad she's telling the world that her baby buys the things, you know. He buys her diamond rings, you know. She said so. She's in love with me and I feel fine. Tells me all the time, you know she said so. I'm in love with her and I feel fine. I'm so glad that she's my little girl. She's so glad she's telling all the world that her baby buys the things, you know. He buys her diamond rings, you know she said so. She's in love with me and I feel fine.
So the following night, they were just halfway through their first song when suddenly I walked on stage with a cup of tea in one hand and the evening paper in the other hand. And I sat down on one of the rostrums that had recently been vacated by John, who jumped down onto the front of the stage where they all line up as a foursome. And I settled down and I opened the evening paper. I had a drink of my tea and there was this unbelievable scene out front with a packed theatre full of the ravenous guys and gals that ever was, all crushed down to the front. They'd all left the seats and crushed down to the front. And the four Beatles were going, help me, yeah. So, as if this wasn't bad enough, one of their lifelong friends and managers, who will remain nameless at this point, couldn't resist the temptation, because he'd seen the Beatles grow up, he'd been with them since before they were stars, and now they're turned into these unbelievable stars, and he still felt that the Beatles and them were the double strongest of pals, and when he saw me go out with the tea in the paper, he couldn't resist this, you see. So this long-time loyal friend of theirs, he grabbed a cup of tea, and he came on stage, and he sat with me, so the both of us are reading bits of the paper and drinking the tea, and the Beatles are saying, get off! Get off! I'll kill you! Get off!
Jimmy Savile, and in the middle of his story, the Christmas 64 number one. Another DJ, Chris Denning, visited the Beatles' dressing room and asked George Harrison how they were enjoying the show.
Great, you know, it's good fun. There's lots of people all come in, which is nice. And we're having a good time, you know, with Freddie and the Dreamers and Yardbirds and everybody. It's good.
Which do you prefer mostly, doing the sketches or doing your numbers?
I think doing our numbers best.
Sketches are lousy.
Yeah, the sketches this year aren't as good as last year's. But, you know, we didn't really have enough time to make them any better. So, but we prefer doing our act now at the end.
Do you play the same numbers every time, Paul?
Well, you call me on the hop, just having my tea here. Yes, every night, same numbers, twice a night. Get used to them after a bit. But it's one way of learning them, you see.
So it's rehearsing them, does it?
Yeah.
But they're all new numbers, really.
Mm. Are you playing the ones off your LP?
What? Yes.
We all keep in.
Yeah, we're playing some off our LP and singles and things. You know, we just mucked in and did the tunes that we think people would like to hear.
Well, Life at the Top could certainly prove tedious, even during a meal break, with a constant barrage of banal questions that needed, nevertheless, to be met with at least an attempt at patience and politeness. It would have been perfectly understandable if that kind of stress had led to a reduction of output. But on the contrary, in 1965, the Beatles not only consolidated, but built on their successes of 1964. They released two more big-selling and influential albums, Help and Rubber Soul, and had three more number one singles. They made their second feature film and played live concert tours in Britain, France, Italy, Spain, and America. And then, at an investiture ceremony at Buckingham Palace, John, Paul, George and Ringo were each awarded the MBE. When Christmas came round again, the Beatles, as of right, occupied their places at the top of both singles and album charts. In later years, many artists, major and minor, have churned out Yuletide songs and seasonal novelties in the generally vain hope of picking up a bonus extra hit. But back in those heady days of the 60s, the Beatles established a record that may never be equaled. Four times a single released at Christmas and four times a number one hit. Four albums released at Christmas and again four times a number one. Here's a title from 1965.
Tickets, yes. It took me so long to find out that I could.
have we done this year?
I see you haven't shaved again.
Well, Ringo, what have we done this year?
We've done a lot of things this year, Paul.
Yes.
Well, we've been away.
Yeah,
and like last year.
We've come back all right.
Aye, we've had a lot of presents sent to us for our birthdays and Christmases.
We'd like to thank you.
Thank you for the presents and the cards.
Thank you for the presents.
If you've enjoyed this programme, tune to 29314567 megacycles. If you can't find that, drop it.
Chica! Be a queen! Be a forgotten never brought to him. China! Down in Vietnam! China. And look at all those bodies. Jordan. China. Floating in the river. Jordan.
Well, that looks as though it's about it for this year.
Well, that should cover Israel.
We certainly tried our best to
please everybody.
Please everybody. If we haven't done what we could have done, we've tried.
And those extracts were from the Beatles' 1965 fan club Christmas record with clear indications that the once carefree mop-tops were rapidly developing a sense of sorrow for the wickedness of the world. Or simply, perhaps, they were growing up, and their newfound sophistication noticeably made its mark during the next 12 months. The album Revolver, released in August 66, has been cited by many as the group's best ever album. Furthermore, although fans worldwide were waiting and hoping for further concert appearances, the four young men had firmly resolved after their August show in San Francisco that touring for them had come to an end. In September, John Lennon was filming in Spain, Paul was in England writing a movie score for The Family Way, while George was in India pursuing his interest in mysticism. But in November, all four Beatles were reunited at EMI's Abbey Road Studios, where they cut the epoch-making single Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields Forever, which was released in February 1967. But despite their manifest changes of direction, the Beatles still kept faith with the loyal members of their fan club, and they recorded at their music publishers' offices a fourth Christmas disc. But as Tony Banner recalls, even here they insisted on a change of formula.
Well, the first three in 1963 and 4 and 5 were more or less basically scripted messages to the fans, and that was really something that was beginning to become a bit repetitive, where each year they would be saying, well, thank you for the birthday cards, thank you for the Christmas cards, thank you for sending in get well cards when Ringo had his tonsils out, etc, etc. And furthermore, they were deviating more and more from the little scripts that were being done, but doing so less humorously, because it was getting a bit repetitive. So by 1966, for a number of reasons, the whole concept of the thing was changed, and they came up with the idea of not just doing thank you messages, but coming up with something that would be in itself a presentation of some sort. They wanted to progress, in other words, and do something a bit different. And the obvious thing to do was a pantomime. Now, the main ideas for the 1966 record, in fact, came from Paul McCartney. There were a lot of firsts involved in the 1966 record, because not only was it the first time that they scripted the thing for themselves, it was the first time that it came out as a two-sided record instead of a single-sided. It was the first time that we got involved in producing a colour sleeve for it, and perhaps most important of all, I don't know, it's the first time that the whole thing had a session to itself. In previous years, the Christmas record had tended to be produced at the back end of the day, after the Beatles had been working at EMI with George Martin on album tracks or on singles or whatever. And in 1966, for the first time, instead of doing it in EMI, we did it in studios of Dick James Music, Dick James the music publisher.
Reggie the Bear and Jasper were huddled around the unlit fire in the centre of the room.
There are no more matches left, Podgy,
said Jasper.
Then buy some, Jasper, old friend,
said Podgy.
Make a list, and afterwards we'll go to the shop and buy matches and candles and buns.
There's no more paper to write on, Podgy.
No need to worry, Jasper. You keep saying to yourself, matches, and I'll keep saying candles until we reach the shop. Then we won't need to write it down. We'll remember.
We'll remember the buns, Podgy.
We both will, Jasper. Matches.
Candles.
Matches.
Candles.
Matches.
candles?
Matches?
Candles?
Well, that was 1966. And by 1967, the emphasis was on satirical humour, with British radio and television as prime targets.
The boys arrive at BBC House.
What do you want?
We have been granted permission, O wise one.
Pass in peace.
Sitting with me in the studio tonight is a cross-section of British youth. I'd like, first of all, to speak to you, Sir Gerald.
Oh, not a bit of it. We have a job to do, Nigel.
Yes, quite. I don't think you're answering my question.
Oh, let me put it this way. There was a job to be done.
On to the next round.
In the recent heavy fighting near Blackpool, Mrs. G. Evans of Solihull was gradually injured. She wants, for all the people in hospital, plenty of jam jars by the Ravelers.
Well, as I said at the beginning of this programme, Boxing Day 1967 was the date of the first screening of the TV special A Magical Mystery Tour, which the Beatles devised, wrote, produced and directed as a vehicle for themselves. It was their first major project since the death in August of their manager, Brian Epstein.
Less than a week after his death, on Friday, September the 1st, in fact, 1967, Paul McCartney called an emergency meeting at Cavendish Avenue, at his London home in St John's Wood. And I was along to that meeting shortly before the rest of the Beatles arrived. And in the hour or so before the group gathered in Paul's lounge to talk about Magical Mystery Tour, Paul admitted to me that his real fear at that time was that if the Beatles cleared off to India at that point in time, the four of them might never come together again as a working band. To him, Magical Mystery Tour represented his chance to prove himself in a kind of management role, if you like.
Day after day, alone on a hill, the man with the foolish grin is keeping perfectly still. But nobody wants to know him, they can see that he's just a fool. And he never gives an answer, but the fool on the hill sees the sun going down. And the eyes in his head see the world spinning round. Well, on the way, head in a cloud, the man of a thousand voices talking perfectly loud. But nobody ever hears him or the sound he appears to make. He never seems to notice, but the fool on the hill sees the sun going down, and the eyes in his head see the world spinning round. Tell what he wants to do, and he never shows his feelings, but the fool on the hill sees the sun going down, and the eyes in his head see the world spinning round.
See the world spinning round.
Initially, Paul McCartney had hoped that Magical Mystery Tour might finish up as a major cinema release, but at least when it was going to become instead a Christmas television special, he hoped that it would gain a lot of praise, both from critics and the public and also within the group itself. I think the main trouble with Magical Mystery Tour was that it had some brilliant ideas in it, and various people have said, with great hindsight, that perhaps it was 10 years ahead of its time and this kind of thing, that it was kind of Monty Python before it existed. In fact, it had too little preparation of any sort. It was really ideas in fertile minds, and particularly in the mind of Paul McCartney. And they did the entire thing themselves. They did not bring in outside experts of any kind. They wanted to prove to themselves that they could produce the whole thing from start to finish. Well, of course, as always, the music of Lennon-McCartney and, in turn, the music of the Beatles saved the day. In other words, the highly successful side of Magical Mystery Tour was the marvellous set of songs that came out of it. Although, at Christmas itself, despite the fact that all the Magical Mystery Tour music was around, the really big hit was the single Hello Goodbye.
You say yes, I say no. You say stop, and I say go, go, go. Oh no, you say goodbye, and I say hello. Hello, hello. I don't know why you say goodbye.
Tony Barrow's personal memories of the Beatles in December 1967 and the song Hello Goodbye, which provided them with yet another Christmas number one. During 1968, the Beatles were a group in little more than name, even though their August single release, Hey Jude, was every bit as good as almost everything that had gone before it. By Christmas, however, there was little interest in corporate activities. On a personal level, Paul was developing his relationship with Linda Eastman, later to become his wife, while John Lennon was deeply involved with Yoko Ono. The public eccentricities of this controversial couple doubtless invited comment, though not of the vitriolic kind forthcoming from some areas of the press and even from close friends, as witness this funny but barbed extract from the 1968 Christmas fan club record.
Once upon a time, there were two balloons called Jock and Yono. They were strictly in love, bound to happen in a million years. They were together, man. Unfortunate timetable, they seemed to have previous experience, which kept calling them one way or another. You know how it is. But they battled on against overwhelming oddities, including some of their beast friends. Being in love, they clung together even more, man, but some of the poisonous monster of outdated busloader hip throwers did stick slightly, and they occasionally had to resort to the dry cleaners. Luckily, this did not kill them, and they weren't banned from the Olympic Games. They lived hopefully ever after, and who could blame them?
1968 was the first year that the Beatles failed to get together for their Christmas record, each making his own contribution separately. It was then left to their DJ friend Kenny Everett to act as producer and edit the tapes together.
I was always round at Eppie's house stealing demos. I got the Magical Mystery Tour years before anybody else because Eppie had it, a demo of it. And I said, well, Eppie, you must go home now for a couple of minutes for a cup of tea. Dragged it home, revoxed it, and then took it back without anybody knowing. So I was chummy with them. And I also knew how to edit. And they said to me, hey, here's a bunch of tapes and records and stuff. Make them into our Christmas.
Make them into our Christmas record, Ken.
So I did. I just made a fun bunch of sounds, really. That was all, that was the point of it, just to make it sound fun, because it was a Christmas thing, and all the fans wanted to hear was were their voices and a bit of jollity. It didn't matter in those days. The madder it was, the better. These days, you have to be sort of coherent and cohesive and digital. But in those days, it was just, oh, anything goes, as long as it's got a Liverpool accent. But I spent a lot of time on it, spent a few hours, right here at the BBC, actually. I just brought it back here and edited it in one of the editing suites here, and then dragged it back and said, there it is, sounds quite good, and make it into a flexi disc.
Hello, this is a big hi and a sincere Merry Christmas from yours truly, Ringo Starr.
I'd like to wish everybody Happy Christmas this year of 1968, going on 69. Happy Christmas, Happy New Year, all the best to you from here.
And we'd like to take this opportunity all the way from America to say Happy Christmas to you, our faithful, beloved fans all over the world who have made our life worth living. We have a special guest here this evening, Mr. Tiny Tim. I'd like to ask him to say a few words.
Oh, hello to you nice Beatles. It's so wonderful and what a thrill it is talking here.
The bizarre Tiny Tim enrolled as a temporary Beatle for Christmas 1968. But Kenny Everett's ingenious inventions notwithstanding, it was becoming well-nigh impossible to preserve a group image. 1969 was dedicated to solo projects with varying degrees of success, but it did also see the creation of their final album, Abbey Road, which was released in September and was still at number one for Christmas. The group, however, was divided by seemingly irreconcilable differences of opinion, with Paul on one side and John, George and Ringo on the other.
Now
One of the songs from Abbey Road, with George Harrison in the unusual role for him of lead singer. But by this time, all four young men considered the Beatles to be something belonging to the past. They therefore had little interest in the fan club. The 1969 Christmas record was the seventh and last, again recorded individually. This time, not even Kenny Everett's efforts could disguise the fact that Ringo's contribution lasted only 16 seconds and George's a mere six.
Yes, Happy New Year,
all of us.
This is George Harrison saying Happy Christmas, Happy Christmas, 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 Happy, Happy.
Oh, good evening to you, good evening to you, gentlemen. Happy to be here. Good evening to you, gentlemen. I fear. Good evening to one and all. I hope you will enjoy the coming sports day of our life is Mama's little boy.
I'd like to say that I hope everybody listening to this has a very happy time at Christmas and has a good, fortunate, lucky new year and a good time to be had by all.
And that really marked the end of the road for the Beatles, the end of an era in the history of pop music. On December the 31st, 1970, Paul McCartney filed a suit in the London High Court seeking dissolution of the Beatles.
Okay, put the red lights off.
This is Johnny Rhythm just saying good night to you all, and God bless you.
So this is Christmas, and what have you done? Another year over, and you won't just be gone. And so this is Christmas.
The Beatles at Christmas was presented by Brian Matthew. Research was by Mark Lewison, and the producer was Phil Hughes. And you might like to know that you can get a book about the Beatles' radio career back in those early days. It's called The Beatles at the Beeb. It's by Kevin Howlett. It costs £2.25, and you can get it from bookshops. That's The Beatles at the Beeb by Kevin Howlett, and it costs £2.25.